From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the impact one white pastor has had on his overwhelmingly black congregation.
Later, the kinship felt by the authors of two recent young adult novels and their characters.
Both of our books are secretly a romp, right? They're both adventure stories.
And both very much genre entries that you write, these sort of very self-aware tropey mysteries, and mine is a very self-aware tropey adventure novel.
We learn some unexpected things about Milwaukee's punk rock scene in the 70s and 80s.
I think that the punk scene in Milwaukee was much more creative than Chicago, obviously a greater city in size, but we had an astonishing number of very imaginative bands.
And we remember theater legend Barbara Cook, who died this week at age 89. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee is saying goodbye to one of its prominent and outspoken faith leaders. For the past 10 years, Steve Jerby has been senior pastor at All People's Church on 2nd and Center.
He stood out as a white man leading a predominantly black congregation. He also became known for his passionate pursuit of racial and social justice.
This Sunday, for the first time in a decade, the congregation will gather without Jerby because he's moving to California to take a position with a church there.
WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Aisha Turner attended a couple of Jerby's final sermons in Milwaukee. She also sat down with him to reflect on his time here and the fight for justice that's at the center of his faith.
It's a Sunday morning at All People's Church. Pastor Steve Jerby, who goes by Pastor Steve, takes to the altar.
A special word of greeting to any visitors that are with us. A reminder, if you've got cell phones or tablets or other devices, to keep those powered on. You might hear something you want to tweet, see something you want to Instagram. You can go ahead and check in on Facebook. Let folks know that you are in church on this Sunday morning.
Pastor Steve rocks black canvas sandals and short sleeves that don't even attempt to conceal his tattoos. His Sunday sermon evokes the sound of protest.
Si se puede, si se puede, si se puede! When worker rights are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back!
He's made the fight for police reform, for racial equity, even for food justice a central part of his ministry.
Black lives matter! Words are powerful. Words have meaning.
Steve Jerby has been the senior pastor of All People's Church for 10 years. And now, he and his family are accepting a new call with a congregation outside of Los Angeles. At his final service on August 6th, a packed crowd at All People's lifted up their prayers.
Go wherever God sends you, because you are a blessing upon the earth, and everyone needs to experience your love.
Unlike many churches, the crowd was diverse. All People's is made up of about 60% African Americans, 30% white people, and 10% Latinos. The building that houses it was erected in 1906 as Epiphany Lutheran. By the 80s, that original church faded under white flight.
And so All People's was the resurrected church in this place, and it made a firm commitment to be rooted in the Harambe neighborhood.
The church remained Lutheran, and that commitment to the neighborhood is part of what drew Pastor Steve to All People's 10 years ago. It was a reflection of the values he had learned growing up. His dad is a pastor and a former member of the Rainbow Coalition. He protested the Democratic National Convention in Chicago back in 1968.
And he was down there, and he got his head busted open by the police there.
Yet, the take-it-to-the-streets attitude that would define Pastor Steve's reputation in Milwaukee wouldn't come until college, during the battle in Seattle. In 1999, members of the World Trade Organization had convened in Seattle, Washington. The meeting drew thousands of protesters concerned about the environmental hazards and rising inequality brought on by globalization.
Hearing the stories coming out of that helped me kind of reframe what, you know, growing up were just kind of like liberal ideals, but what it actually meant to put those in practice.
By the time he was in seminary, protests and politics would be key elements of Pastor Steve's faith.
It was actually a WTO protest in seminary where I first wore my collar to a rally.
As Pastor Steve's activism grew, so did his interest in Milwaukee.
I was living in the Twin Cities. Milwaukee had this great reputation in the Lutheran realm for innovative urban ministry.
For instance, the Lutheran Synod had a big hand in forming MICA, the interfaith group committed to addressing issues such as education, housing, and drug abuse. Pastor Steve landed at All Peoples in 2007. The church would push him far beyond what he could have imagined. In May of 2012, 13-year-old Darius Simmons was gunned down by John Henry Spooner, his 75-year-old white neighbor. Darius had spent his summers working in the church's community garden. His mother was a member of All Peoples. She was standing on her doorstep when her son was killed.
So, because she was an eyewitness to the murder, standard protocol calls for her to be isolated from the scene and investigated as quickly as possible. And the way that they did that was in the back of a squad car while her baby boy bleeds out on the street.
This outraged the community.
And there were hearings, and Fire and Police Commission did a review of it. And ultimately, there was a non-apology given that while it may be perceived as insensitive, no rules were broken. And so, you know, the lack of humanity in that moment for how Patricia was treated, I think, and because of her connection to the church, because of her family's involvement in the church, we had to, as part of the pastoral care in that moment, be involved in the police community conversation.
Pastor Steve joined protests and even called for the resignation of Police Chief Edward Flynn. Then, in 2014, he was pushed further. A police officer killed Dontre Hamilton in Red Arrow Park. Dontre was shot 14 times. Pastor Steve could be found shouting Black Lives Matter side by side with the Hamilton family. On Pastor Steve's final Sunday in Milwaukee, Dontre's brother, Nate Hamilton, sat in the pews.
He said he often drew strength from Pastor Steve.
Yeah, it's been amazing to not just my family, but all families that he came in contact with.
In that final sermon, Pastor Steve spoke of providence.
Providence is what tells us I can do all things through him who strengthens me. When I think about the ministry that we have done together in this place, it has been a ministry of providence. There have been some dark times for our community. There have been times when it seemed like the enemy was going to win.
He also celebrated the joys of those years. He recalled the church working to expand a local meal program and hosting summer camps to help young people find their purpose. In order to reach the victories, the church had to work together with the community and even rely on international partnerships to sustain momentum. All Peoples is connected to a congregation called the Heroes of Faith in El Salvador.
And the pastor there, Santiago, has been an incredible encouragement and support to me in my time here. Even though my Spanish is terrible and his English is as good as my Spanish. And yet, when gang violence hits his community, I know what it is to minister to parents who have lost children to violence. And so we have this deep connection and this prayerful commitment to one another. That, you know, language barriers can be brushed aside because the connection of faith and brotherhood is so strong between us.
The pastors have visited each other a handful of times. Mostly, they offer prayer and guidance via Facebook, sending messages in the middle of the night.
And then we pray that Google Translate does a decent job. So.
Folks are looking. This congregation.
As for the work Pastor Steve and his parishioners have done together, he expects it will linger.
Folks will wonder, will All Peoples still be known as a visible sign of God's providence in the world. I am confident that you will continue to answer that call.
He asked the congregation, do you even know the power that is in this place?
This is not a church that is afraid of hard things. This is not a community that will let the forces of the enemy conquer us. That this is a community that stands firm on the promise of justice and peace. We're going to be servants of our neighbors, to get down and wash the stankiest feet that are out there, to do whatever it takes to make sure that the gospel love that we know in this place gets declared on every corner where we go to. And we can do all things through the one who strengthens us, Jesus Christ. And that's our reason.
This summer, Pastor Steve will head west to lead the congregation at Bethel Encino Elka outside of Los Angeles. It's a church that's looking to take its outreach and charity work to the next level of justice and advocacy. He hopes to help them along in that journey. For WUWM, I'm Aisha Turner.
You can read more about this story at WUWM.com.
Race and ethnicity reporting supported by The Doman Company.
A quick break now, and then we'll speak with two authors of recent young adult novels about their irascible but appealing characters. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The leading characters in two recent young adult novels live their lives in different eras, but one gets the feeling that if they were to meet somehow, they'd feel a kinship. That was the case with their authors, who connected well enough that they became fast friends and undertook a book tour together.
Former Milwaukee and Brittany Cavallaro's latest mystery novel is the second in her series that updates the Holmes and Watson story. The last of August brings back Charlotte Holmes and Jamie Watson, each modern-day descendants of the famed Arthur Conan Doyle investigators.
Mackenzie Lee's latest book is called The Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue and features a roguish teenager's harrowing adventures across Europe during the 18th century equivalent of a gap year between schooling and adulthood. Lee and Cavallaro joined us on a recent trip to Milwaukee. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you
so much for having us.
So these books feel like they're literary spiritual cousins, and you must feel that. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't both be here at the same time.
Sure. For sure.
Did you know of each other's work before it got to this point?
No, I actually... I found Bree's book because I had heard from friends that it was tremendously good and I should read it. It was not on my radar otherwise, even though we share a publisher. And I picked it up and I remember reading it in sort of a restaurant at a train station and just being like obsessed and consumed by it. And it's always great when you sort of like read the books of people before you know the person, because then you know you actually like the book and you're
right,
not just
biased.
Right,
you don't have to pretend forever.
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes.
No, and the same with me. I love Mary Shelley and This Monstrous Thing, which is Mackenzie's first book. It's sort of this like wonderful, gothic, very smart YA novel, and I had read it. And so when she wrote me a little note on Twitter, I was like, oh my God, you're writing me. And I went to Boston for a conference and through a series of unfortunate events had nowhere to stay. Mackenzie put me up and we ended up talking until 5 a.m. that night because we were kismet. Yeah.
It's kind of nice when both of you feel like you're like tricking the other into being your friend.
Yes,
I think
exactly.
We both approached with the feeling of like, oh, I have to be careful how I phrase. I don't want to scare her off. So it worked out really well.
Yeah. Lest it becomes some kind of author version of Single White Female.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the other thing that's interesting about this is, Brittany, your book plays out in modern day, whereas, Mackenzie, your book plays out centuries ago. And at the same time, somehow they managed to feel like they could be contemporaries. I can't quite wrap my head around how you pulled that off.
I think part of it is that both of them have sort of these romantic, passionate friendships at the center. That both sort of toe the line between friendship and actual romanticism. And I think part of it comes from the fact that Bree's book is based on Sherlock Holmes, where Sherlock and Watson sort of have this romantic friendship in the source material. And my book is set in the 1700s, when this idea of a romantic friendship was very popular and very sort of in vogue. And so I think the way they often feel sort of linked is because of these central relationships kind of mirror each other. And even just the dynamic between Jamie and Charlotte in Bree's book versus Percy and Monty in mine, I think, is very similar, where you have sort of a straight man and then a wildly off the rails man.
an evil genius,
yeah.
Or a wonderful rake. No, I agree. And I also think that both of our books are rooted in research, mm-hmm. And a love for some times past, even though mine is set in present day. It's drawing a lot from the late 1800s. But both of our books are secretly a romp. Right? They're both adventure stories.
And both very much genre entries that you write, these sort of very self-aware tropey mysteries, and mine is a very self-aware tropey adventure novel.
and you have used both romp and rake in the...
Not words that come up now, as often as they should.
Well, and
really.
Now I don't have to. I will cross them off.
My work here is done.
But, you know, it also struck me that you have a modern-day novel with sort of a gothic sensibility, maybe, and you have an centuries-old novel with a modern sensibility, which means that they sort of meet maybe in the 1900s.
They're all hanging out in a bar in 1948.
I was going to say, we need some time-traveling fan fiction
exactly.
There.
What do you find most challenging? Both of you are writing from the standpoint of a male protagonist. What was challenging about that for you, if anything?
I don't think for me it's any more challenging than writing from a female protagonist, primarily because all of my characters are living imagined circumstances and have sort of a background and even an experience with identity elements that I share with them that is different than my own. So for me, writing a man is just sort of like one more thing you have to sort of add on top of a very complex identity that you are imagining what it would be like to be that person and also how they would react to their situation and their circumstances.
As always, Mackenzie manages to say exactly what I was going to say, except a complete smart paragraph where mine is going to be peppered with weird jokes and trailing off. But I agree with you. And I'm very much a Watson, I think. I really relentlessly mythologize my own life. I tend to romanticize things. Jamie and I have a lot in common, and that made it fairly easy for me to get into his shoes while also thinking – I was very deliberate about wanting to write a 17-year-old boy who was more emotionally astute than we give most 17-year-old boys credit for.
You're stealing all my questions.
But that was important to me.
Well, right. I mean, I think what's interesting is that a 17 or 18-year-old boy is not typically someone we would think as being – maybe as emotionally advanced or at least as aware of his emotions as Jamie is.
Yeah. And I've worked with so many – I mean, I teach high school students in the summer, smart high school kids, and I work with them on their writing. And these boys are just as soulful and thoughtful and careful with the way that they comport themselves in the world as the girls are. And I think we're really selling our teenage boys short if we can't – imagine a world where there are at least some boys out there who are, you know, definitely very tuned into their sense of right and wrong, even if they aren't always making the best decisions. I want to say that they are, you know, in touch with what they're feeling.
When in general, I think we're so quick to box teenagers in general. We tell teenage girls often you love things too much and you're not allowed to have too many emotions. And I thought about that a lot while writing my first novel, This Monstrous Thing, which is largely about Mary Shelley writing Frankenstein, which she did when she was like 19 years old. And I really think teenage girls are the most like undersold part of the human experience. And with teenage boys, though, too, we tell them you can't be too emotional. And teenage girls, whatever they like, it's the first thing we sort of dismiss as being like, that's uncool because teenage girls like it. It's hard to be a teenager.
It really is. Yeah. You know, and especially boy-girl friendships, when you're a teenager, everyone is so determined for you to decide exactly what they are mm-hmm. so it's intelligible to others. And I think that's unfair. I had so many passionate friendships when I was a teenager. My best friend at boarding school was a boy. We did everything together. And I think it's really important to allow for some gray area in these friendships where people have to feel their way through them. And it's okay, you know, if you don't necessarily, if you aren't dating the person who's closest to you in your life, even if they are the, you know, the gender that you typically fancy. I think we have to leave some room, some wiggle room in there.
I mean, it's interesting to think about it, and it's, you know, I'm 30 years removed from being 18 here, but one of my probably two closest friends when I was in high school was a girl, and I'm still trying to make sense of what that relationship was. Mm-hmm. Can you separate out the relationships in these books from the romp, or are they part and parcel of the same?
That's
could you write just a romp without this sort of complex relationship at its heart?
Honestly, that's what I sort of started out thinking I was going to do. I started writing this book purely sort of for fun with the honest intention that no one would ever read it. And I just wanted to write sort of – I was having a very hard time with the project I was under contract for. And so I wanted to write something that was just for me and just for fun and sort of to remind myself that writing could be really fun again. And then as I was trying to write this sort of like nonsense, ridiculous historical adventure novel, what ended up coming out of it was this nonsense, ridiculous historical adventure novel with this very complicated relationship between these two young men at its center. And it's complicated for a lot of reasons. And now what I have is I often say it's like the funniest book you'll ever read about like alcoholism and abuse and like chronic illness. So they're sort of, they've become inseparable.
It's a comedy.
It is. It's hilarious.
Alcoholism hasn't been so much fun since Otis the Town Drunk on the Andy Griffith Show. In both of these, there is a lot of, I feel like this is the word, cracking dialogue. And I wondered if there is a trick for each of you to be clever without being too clever, or what we sometimes call clever with a K.
Revision.
Yeah, I think I really have this tendency to want to go for the meta joke every single time, which with my setup, I'm kind of like setting myself up for. You know, my main characters are the great-great-great-grandchildren of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, so they're aware of their ancestry. And it's something I definitely have to rein in a little bit because winks are always fun, but, you know, if you're winking too much, you look like you have something
then
horrible in
blinking.
Your eye.
Yeah,
then you're just blinking. And I think it's also the humor has to just stay really rooted in the character. It's really fun and tempting, especially for me, to write a scene where, like, the two of them are just arguing over a box of chocolate for, like, 40 pages where nothing happens. But I can't let myself do that. Or I can let myself do that, and then it has to go away. It has to be deleted.
For me, the humor is such a part of the voice of this novel because humor, especially for the main character whose name is Monty, is sort of his coping mechanism slash way of avoiding dealing with the real and sort of difficult things in his life. So the humor is very integral to who he is and also the arc of the book. And for me, writing humor is all about revising. It's like comic timing, I think, in a play where you have to land it at just the right minute with the right cadence and the right amount of words in a sentence. And the only way to really write characters that are funnier than you is to be able to revise them over and over again. I would never be this witty in my day-to-day life.
I don't know. You're pretty funny in here.
Wow.
But is there a trick to doing that? And I hate making it seem like there are tricks, like you're whipping out, okay, this is how I take this out of my writing arsenal. But you're also doing this and having to be sort of historically sensitive, that, mm-hmm. you know, the humor has to make sense in its time and place.
Mm-hmm. Well, so much of it, too, is, I mean, part of writing a historical novel in general is towing the line between what is historically accurate and also what is going to be accessible for modern readers. Because if any historical fiction novel, I think, were 100% historically accurate, modern readers would be so alienated from it that it would be difficult to sort of look past so many of the attitudes and beliefs that are now just like horrifically dated, but were so much a part of the fabric of society back then. So the humor is sort of just like with anything, you have to learn to toe that very difficult line between serving the history and also serving the contemporary readers who are going to be the ones who ultimately are reading and relating to it.
All right. So I want to bring our listeners up to date. Brittany, since we last spoke and you wrote your first of the Charlotte Holmes books, you have left Milwaukee, correct?
I did. My husband has a job in California and we have sadly left for sunnier shores.
You sound awfully happy about being sadly.
You know, we miss Wisconsin a lot, actually. It felt really good driving back today.
If I remember correctly, you grew up in Illinois, is that right?
I did. I grew up in Illinois and then did graduate work in Madison and Milwaukee and bounced back and forth. I love it here so much.
Is there any difference? I mean, it seems like a strange question, but is there any difference being a writer in California and being a writer in the Midwest?
I mean, I can give you the real nuts and bolts answer, which is that you can really afford to be a writer much more so in the Midwest. And for a writer, time really is the most valuable thing in a literal sense that you can have. And so we've kind of had to, you know, figure things out a little bit as we've gone in California. We're actually thinking about coming back for that reason, not because it's not wonderful out there, but because, you know, it's a little bit harder to hack it.
Mackenzie, I was doing a little digging around and prepping
for
this.
What the internet is for.
Yes. Are you the same Mackenzie that had an internship at NPR?
I am the same Mackenzie that interned
at NPR. Wait, don't tell me.
Yes, that's me.
Okay, so let me ask you this. It's not a wait, don't tell me specific question. However,
I was going to say, let me cut you off. Yes, Carl Castle is on my voicemail. We'll just... Brie didn't even know that.
Fun fact. Always pick up when I call.
Now you're going to want to, like,
I said,
call her at times you know she's not home. Well, okay, so if the internet is right, as you left, wait, don't tell me, you left with a recipe for a particular spin on the Chipwich.
Oh, yes, the chocolate chip cookie sandwich, yeah.
Yes, so apparently I am the resident ice cream correspondent here, and I feel like it would be remiss if I didn't ask you about that chocolate chip cookie sandwich.
Well, so, wait, don't tell me, when I was working there, I don't know if they still do this on their blog, every Monday would do a sandwich Monday where we would eat a different sandwich that was ridiculous for various reasons. And so I wanted to leave my legacy. And my legacy is actually less the ice cream and more the cookie that was involved in the sandwich. My family has a traditional cookie recipe.
Are these ones you made me?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes. So this is it's a very specific kind of cookie that the trick to it is you bake it for like 4 to 5 minutes so that it doesn't totally set up, and then you freeze them and then you eat them and they taste like cookie dough. And this is like the primary currency I have in my life is making these cookies for people. And they were legendary all through like my high school and my hometown. And we sold them one summer to fund a trip to D.C. for my sister and I to compete in National History Day. And so it was more that I was using the ice cream as a way to get the cookies into Sandwich Monday. I could have put bologna between them. I was like, we just got to get something between the cookies to make them a sandwich.
Brittany, you have any recipes you want to share?
No, I'm just going to sit here and stare longingly at Mackenzie until she makes me those cookies again.
I'm kind of bumming that.
I mean, I brought my mixer. It's in the car, so I'll have to go get it.
Well, listen, the books are really enjoyable, and chatting with both of you is as well. Let me just say, Brie Cavallaro and Mackenzie Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mackenzie Lee's latest young adult novel is called The Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue. Brittany Cavallaro's latest is called The Last of August. We spoke with him recently before a joint appearance at Boswell Book Company.
Another break now, and then as the 7th annual Milwaukee Punk Festival gets underway, we explore the history of the punk movement here. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. That continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee is known for its summer festivals, from Summerfest to Irish Fest, German Fest, and increasingly Milwaukee Punk Fest. The citywide festival celebrating punk music, art, and culture is into its 7th year. But the history of the punk scene here is much older.
Brick Through the Window, an oral history of punk rock, new wave, and noise in Milwaukee 1964 to 1984, came out earlier this year and is the work of 4 authors, Steve Nodine, Eric Beaumont, Clancy Carroll, and Dave Lurson. Lurson, who's also a regular Lake Effect contributor, joined us in February to represent the whole team and look back on that era with us. Welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be here.
Well, and let's start with the title of this book and what it represents. Brick Through the Window is a follow-up to an earlier book on the Milwaukee music scene. What does Brick Through the Window imply?
Brick Through the Window was the title of a song by Richard Lavallier, who was a member of the original Haskells, who I would say were the most important punk rock band in Milwaukee in the late 1970s in terms of building an audience not only for themselves but for the punk rock scene here in town. Brick Through the Window then carried over into Richard's next band, the Oil Tasters, who had some international successes and an album out and became kind of a cult item around the world. So it's a song title, but also I think it suggests something about an aspect of punk rock, a kind of forceful response to the world we live in.
It has metaphor written all over it.
It definitely does, and the lyric of the song, as I recall, really has to do with a frustrated response to situations for which there seemed to be no better response at that moment.
Why do you think chronicling this period of the Milwaukee music scene is so important?
Well, it laid the foundations for many things to come afterward. The so-called alternative rock scene, alternative rock is a term I've never been comfortable with. It doesn't have a very specific meaning and meant less and less and less after a while, but it certainly grew out of what the punk rock scene was. Also, other things like heavy metal, I think, was influenced by punk rock, took on a more aggressive thrust during the 1980s because of punk rock, both here in Milwaukee and internationally. So it was important musically, culturally. I would like to think that punk rock around the world stimulated an idea of opposing the kind of culture that most of us would find as the fallback, the corporate entertainment industry, even taking it beyond that. I mean, social expectations that aren't really thought through. I think, at least originally, to be part of the punk rock scene meant that you were thinking about these things and maybe coming up with some different conclusions as to how you wanted to live your life.
This book actually starts in 1964, which for a lot of people who might not be familiar with the scene, they might think that that sounds awfully early for punk rock.
Well, nobody was using the term punk rock until the early 1970s. I think it was Cream Magazine's Dave Marsh who coined the term as a way of finding a label for a kind of music, an undercurrent in the 1960s that was ignored by FM rock radio and by Rolling Stone magazine and so on, a sort of simpler... Maybe cruder, not always though, but kind of the despised undercurrent. It was not the music of Woodstock. It was not the music that of Lynyrd Skynyrd or many other bands that became popular in the early 70s. So punk rock was coined as this oppositional sort of form of music. And, to be called a punk before that time was not a complimentary thing. I mean, to be a punk, you're embracing something that had an outsider, outlaw status at that point. But since that time, all these other kinds of phenomenon, cyberpunk and steampunk, which have no particular connection in my mind with the music of punk rock, but the word punk has become sort of branded as this... way of being in maybe drastic alternative to what's given to us in our society and culture.
It's almost a badge of honor.
A badge of honor, yes. What was once an insult is now a badge of honor.
Do you think the punks, if you will, from the early 70s, would they be happy about the co-opting of the word punk here, 40 years later?
Well, I imagine that there are, as with anything, purists who are just utterly dismayed by the course of the world since that time. People who would say that there has been no good punk rock since 1978 or thereabouts. I mean, it was kind of interesting to join up, if you will, to become a member of the punk scene here in Milwaukee and elsewhere. Meant that you had to, among other things, examine your record collection to see what would fit. What predecessors there were to this music, what kinds of things might be tolerated, or what did you have to like take to the resale store and get rid of? So there were some big decisions that you had to make about that. There were some people who always took a very narrow view of what punk rock should sound like and how punks should behave and what it all meant. I'd like to think that I always took a broader view of it myself, and I think that to answer the question about how do we feel about this today, there are many answers to that question. But obviously, you know, there's been not only the influence of punk rock on music to come from after that time, but there's been a resurgence of interest in punk rock among people unborn at the time that this happened, which I find really interesting. Punk rock really never went away, but I see more and more, you know, 20-year-olds who seem fascinated by it and would like to start their own bands and you know, do it over again.
Is it gratifying?
Yes, I think it means I was on the right side of history for a change.
Either way, I guess it required one to definitely trade in all of their Bread albums.
Yeah, Bread didn't quite make it. I mean, there were all kinds of great debates over which David Bowie albums would you want. I mean, again, I had a broader sensibility than some people did. But yeah, there definitely was a sense that mainstream rock music by the mid-70s had lost its energy, had lost its intelligent, you know, inquisitiveness. It had lost many of the things that made it special in the 1960s. And for some people, punk rock was a way of kind of going before these changes happened, getting back to what we saw as sort of the roots of things.
So how did this scene in a place the size of Milwaukee and, you know, geographically a place like Milwaukee compare to the punk scene in the much larger places we might more readily, you know, associate with punk?
I think that the punk scene in Milwaukee was much more creative than Chicago, obviously a greater city in size. But we had an astonishing number of very imaginative bands, songwriting-wise. I think songwriting was really a strength of the scene here in Milwaukee. And I think in that way, we were the equal of cities like Boston and San Francisco. You can't really compare us to New York or London, of course. But I would say that Milwaukee was one of the top second-tier cities in the world at that point for punk rock.
Do you think the people who study this kind of stuff nationally give Milwaukee its due?
Well, we produced a number of bands by the early 1980s that had worldwide impact, if only in an underground kind of way. But certainly the Violent Femmes, you know, come to mind first and foremost. But bands like Die Kreuzen, who influenced the coming of grunge in a few years, Plastic Land were very important with the psychedelic revival that was occurring during the 1980s. A number of bands, Couch Flambeau and the Frogs, you know, achieved, you know, measures of underground success. The Bodines were kind of a latecomer in the whole thing, but you know, their theme songs got on. They did theme songs for situation comedies on TV later on, and remained popular. So yeah, I think that Milwaukee did have a very, very good impact on the world, and many of our bands were widely respected.
Well, what happened in the mid '80s to kind of end this particular phase of the punk scene?
Well, there were two prominent clubs, venues in Milwaukee from the late 70s into the early 80s. The first one, Zack's North Avenue, which is where the first wave of punk rock coalesced around that. And then the Starship, which is in downtown Milwaukee, opened in the early 80s and was around for a couple of years. The closing of the Starship marks a very good end point for all of this. Afterward, I mean, you know, punk rock and the bands that had been playing were diffused in other venues around town. You could say that maybe the scene was not quite as intimate or coherent after that point, or that just became really big. The seeds spread, you know, in many different places, and it began to turn into something else. Again, if you want to call it alternative rock, maybe a music with wider appeal that had a basis in what punk rock was a couple years earlier.
Do you get the sense, as you work to compile the stories for this book, are people still happy to be talking about this period in their lives?
I think people have become happier, more happy to talk about it. And part of it is, you know, you know, we get older and people begin to die. There were a lot of funerals for a few years of people, who musicians and other people involved in the scene. And it begins to make one think about, you know, the past a little bit more. There were a couple of musical events, Lest We Forget, at Turner Hall several years ago, which was a kind of reunion of a lot of the surviving musicians. There are all kinds of websites now, MilwaukeeRockPosters.com, and programs on you know, other you know, non-commercial radio stations that play a lot of this music. So yeah, I think that most people involved in this have a sense that this was a very important part of their lives, and maybe even a basis for what they did later on. And you know, nostalgia can be an unhealthy thing if you are overly preoccupied with it, but a person who has no nostalgia is probably a very unhappy person. They have nothing happy to look back upon.
Amazing to be talking about it, though, knowing that the you know, sort of the end of that period is, you know, almost 35 years ago.
Yes, that is kind of mind-boggling to me, to imagine how much time has gone by since then. I mean, it was certainly, you know, a youth-led movement, though I would have to say that in Milwaukee, there were probably 10 people under the age of 20 who were involved in this. I was one of them. Most of the original wave of punks in Milwaukee in 1978 era were, you know, people in their 20s, a lot of people with artistic inclinations of one kind or other who were drawn to it. Some of them already had one foot in what happened in the 1960s with some of the more radical things here in Milwaukee. It took a couple of years before word got out to most of the high schools in the area. And by the 80s, at the Starship, it became truly a more youthful thing than it was at the beginning.
Do you still have your vinyl from those days?
The local stuff, yes, 45s and so on. Yeah, it was a flourishing scene, and most of this music, I think, is still very listenable today.
Dave Lurson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson, along with Steve Nodine, Eric Beaumont, and Clancy Carroll, is the co-author of the book Brick Through the Window, An Oral History of Punk Rock, New Wave, and Noise in Milwaukee, 1964 to 1984. You'll find a link to the full Milwaukee Punk Fest schedule, which is going on now, at WUWM.com.
Right now we're hearing one of the bands that will play at the festival, Faux Fiction, and their song Racing the Red Lights.
We'll take one last break, and then we'll shift gears to the music of Barbara Cook, who died this week at 89. You are listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Everybody says don't, everybody says don't, everybody says don't, it isn't right, don't, it isn't nice. Everybody says don't, everybody says don't, everybody says don't walk. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Barbara Cook died this week. The theater and cabaret icon had been singing professionally for almost 70 years. As a young woman, she debuted the roles of Marion the Librarian in The Music Man and Cunegonda in Candide. And in the second half of her career, she became a cabaret star and an expert in interpreting the music of Stephen Sondheim.
We were lucky enough to speak with her twice on this show, most recently in 2012 when she sang at Alverno College. It was a preview of her then-upcoming 85th birthday show at Carnegie Hall. She just released an album then called The Nearness of You. It steered her more toward jazz than musical theater, which necessitated a different kind of an accompaniment.
As long as I've decided to swing, it makes life much easier if I find somebody who's very, very good at that, a real jazz pianist rather than a theater pianist, you know? It just helps so much. You don't have to work quite so hard because they're doing so much of the swingy, jazzy work for you.
And it sounds like you were also having a lot of fun.
Yeah, I do. I have great fun doing this. I can't remember enjoying a show as much as I enjoy this one.
I'm curious why you think this particular show has affected you that way.
Well, there are things that people don't expect from me at all, and I was nervous about doing it. Stephen Holden of the New York Times, for instance, I thought, oh, my Lord, what is Stephen going to say? Barbara, what do you think you're doing now? Give us some more Sondheim. Cut this stuff out. You know, I didn't know if he'd like it or not, and he does, thank goodness. You know, he's our one big guy here in the city for cabaret, and he liked it very much, so that gave me a little more confidence.
Among some of the standards that you've chosen on this, like Hoagie Carmichael tunes, there are some newer songs that I thought were such interesting choices. And the New York State of Mind, the Billy Joel tune, was such an interesting choice. And I thought you did such a great job with it.
Comes down to reality, and it's fine with me, 'cause I've let it slide. Don't care if it's Chinatown or on Riverside. I don't have any reasons. I left them all behind. I'm in a New York state of mind.
Oh, thank you. It's a terrific song.
And again, not one that we would expect, necessarily.
No, not at all.
You know, you talked about the voice, as you age, the voice changing. Is that something that changes also as you get older? You just sort of say, you know what, I'm going to go for it. It doesn't really matter.
Well, I think it is. You know, I think as we get older, most of us relax about who we are, embrace ourselves more, you know. As you get older, I think it's easier to say, look, this is it, folks. You know, it ain't going to change much more than this. So take it or leave it.
It is kind of a freeing thing, isn't it?
Very much so.
Do you still do master classes with
us? Yes.
As you're working with the next generation of singers, what have you been observing? Are people ready to sort of step into the kind of career that you've had?
Well, I work so often with very young people, you know, as master classes. And that kind of choice is way, way down the line, I think, for a lot of people. The thing that I try to stress is that if you just think this would be a very sweet, nice thing to do, gee, I'd like to sing, forget it. Forget it. It's got to be something that you're willing to put your life's blood into to make a difference, do you know? And also, the other thing is people are so intent upon showing you that they can sing. So that becomes their entire message. Look at me, I can sing. Well, a lot of people can sing. What are you going to do with it, you know? I always want to be let in. Let me in. Let me know who you are. And actually, it's the easier thing to do, but you don't realize that immediately. How can I put this? To be exactly who you are. For instance, I say to people, you are enough. You are enough. You are always enough, all of us, in life and everywhere. We're enough. And we don't have to pretend to be something we're not. The trick is to learn how to really be, to be on stage when you're performing. And if you learn to do that, then, you know, that's where safety lies. This very thing that seems so so frightening and makes you feel so vulnerable is the very place where safety lies. Because if you can learn to be there on stage authentically for us, then we fall right into whatever you're doing. And that's just going to happen. So you have less to worry about, actually. But it takes time to do that. It takes time to trust it.
I was going to say it takes a certain kind of confidence and a willingness to show yourself warts and all.
Exactly.
And most of us, as you say, most of us are terrified of doing that. We want to present our best self.
Yeah, and also we don't trust ourselves. We don't embrace who we are. We think we ought to sound like somebody else or dress like somebody else. Or it's so hard to believe, I think, for some young people, that they are really what we want. We want you. We want you. We want you standing there alive for us, being. As simple as that is and as difficult as that is, that's what we always want. In life, too, you know, you're not interested in people who are not authentic, in people who are phonies or, you know, decide they need to sound like somebody else or dress like somebody else. You're just not interested. We always want the authentic self, the authentic person.
And that's, to me, the best advice you could give anybody about anything.
I think so. I ask young people to become more interested in what's happening in the world, to read the newspaper, to understand what's going on, because that way you have more to offer us, and you're more alive and more in the moment in the way the world is right now.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking time today to talk with me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, dear. Bye-bye.
It's not the pale moon that excites me, that thrills and delights me.
Theater and cabaret legend Barbara Cook speaking on Lake Effect in 2012. She died this week at age 89. We're going out with the title track of her 2012 album, The Nearness of You.
It isn't your sweet conversation that brings this sensation. Oh, no. It's just the nearness of you.
And that's the Friday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski, Joy Powers, and Mayon Silver. We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz, Rachel Morello, and Aisha Turner.
And we get web and social media support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from Jason Reavy.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock. Have a great weekend and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.
To enchant me.